time where religious conversations can seem tense or even taboo. I sit down each week with a different guest to talk about what they believe, what shaped that belief, and why it matters. My name's Tony Vicenda, and this is The Threshold. Welcome back to The Threshold, everybody. I am so sorry that we missed you guys last week. One of our other projects, Catholic Bomb Co., just got really nutty, and we had to take a little bit of time just to focus in on that. But during that time, I was actually able to get a few weeks ahead on recording and work with our new editor, Mark Guiney, to put together some stuff that I'm really excited about for The Threshold. This week, I got to sit down with a guest that I was so excited to have on The Threshold, and that's Brandon Vaught. You guys might know Brandon Vaught from any number of things that he does online, whether that's Word on Fire with Bishop Robert Barron, whether that's his work with the Return series, Claritas U, any of the books that he's written, including the new book that we talk about in the interview. I really hope that you guys are able to walk away with some amazing observations about Brandon's life and the way that he lives out his faith. So let's talk about what really matters with Brandon Vaught. Hi, Brandon. How are you doing today?
Hey, Tony. Doing great, man. It's always great to talk with you.
Now, where are you at this morning? Are you at home? Where are you at?
I am in my office right outside of sunny Orlando, Florida.
So I'm really excited to talk to you, even if it's the afternoon for you and early in the morning for me.
That's right.
Today, I really want to thank you for being on. I would love to get you to tell people a little bit about, you know, who you are, and a little bit more about kind of who Brandon Vaught is.
Sure. So my name's Brandon. I am a happily married father of five children with a sixth child on the way. So probably an anomaly among many of my peers. I'm about 31 years old, and I got my degree from Florida State University in mechanical engineering. But after working as an engineer for 5 years, I ended up taking a new job with a Catholic ministry called Word on Fire, which is a ministry run by Bishop Robert Barron, who's a bishop in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, and he's kind of one of the forefront leaders in the American Catholic Church. I am a convert to Catholicism, so I was raised Protestant. I was born and raised in a Presbyterian church, and then I got involved with the Methodist campus ministry in college. But then during my senior year, I engaged this long search and study through the Catholic Church. And a couple weeks before I graduated, decided that I wanted to become Catholic. So converted to Catholicism about 10 years ago. And shortly after that, got married, had our first child, got a new job doing engineering stuff, and the rest has been history. So that's probably a short cursory background into who I am.
Awesome. And I can't wait to come back to your faith journey a little bit later. But first, I just want to ask you a couple questions to kind of get us going this morning, but also give people a little bit of a deeper sense of who you are. I want to try out a new question on you that I haven't asked on the podcast before. And that is, what is something that you're afraid of?
Oh, good one. I'm afraid of many things. I think probably as a husband and a father, one of my greatest fears is not being able to provide for my family. My wife stays at home. She homeschools all of our children. So everything really relies on me to provide for my family, to provide a house, to provide an income, to provide food, to provide safety, to provide leadership, to provide virtue. So it's constantly a terror of mine that I'll come up short in any of these areas, and that the people in my life who deeply rely on me are going to be found wanting. So that's probably the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah, I totally resonate with that, especially for, I think, people who work in either the online world or the church world. And so people who work in the online church world, it's there's always equal terror, I think, around kind of how the work that we do distracts from that, and if it will actually sustain our families or if it's a distraction from it.
Yeah, so that's a good point. And I think there's a lot of volatility with anybody who works like you and I do in the online world or in the realm of religious ministry. And when you combine those two things, you get maximum volatility. So as a husband and a father, it's probably one of my greatest concerns.
Yeah, that actually takes me into our next question, which you said about maximum volatility. How do you deal with, and I know nobody ever directs it at you, because I know there's this perception out there that Brandon Vaught is just an angel and a perfect cherubic example of what what a human should be. But how do you deal with criticism?
Oh, well, you know, I don't know who you've been talking to, because I could point to plenty of critics online, offline, who have identified just some of my many faults. But one thing I hope maybe we'll talk about this later on is 5 years ago, I started a website called strangenotions.com, which brings together Catholics and atheists to dialogue about big questions, things like God, morality, science, and meaning. And so over these last 5 years, I've had nearly daily interactions with thousands of atheists and agnostics and skeptics. So these are people who vigorously disagree with me on just about every important issue. And many times energized to express their disagreement in less than charitable terms. And so I have lots of experience with people who criticize me. I've learned over the years that if you want to interact with people, whether online or offline, you just need to develop a thick skin. You just can't take criticisms personally. And I know, I get it. That's easy to say and hard to do. And I know that's the advice that people usually give. But if you don't follow that advice, you're going to be in big trouble very fast. I remember one of my favorite authors, John Acuff, he talks about the hater math, where John writes books and he says, you know, if I write a book and it's on Amazon and there's 100 reviews and 99 of those reviews are 5 stars and they're just glowing with positive endorsements, but there's one 1-star review from somebody who, you know, probably didn't even read the book and leaves this snarky 10-word review, that's the only review that I see. That's the only one I remember. Yeah. So he says, like, yeah, one bad review plus 99 good reviews equals one bad review. And I think that's how most of us see the world. I mean, we focus too excessively on criticism, but it won't do you any good. You need to get thick skin. You need to remember that in most cases, most people who criticize you aren't seeing the big picture. They don't know you. They haven't wrapped their head around the whole context of even what they're criticizing. So that's something I've learned over my many years of engaging people.
Yeah, no, I think that's huge. And it's something that there, every time I get into one of those conversations, I have to ask myself, am I just being too sensitive about this? Or is this actually worth arguing about? Like, is this actually something I need to be upset or to be worked up about?
And so, in our tradition of Catholicism, there's so much advice from the saints when it comes to humility in this regard. And many saints have said some version of, whenever somebody criticizes you, you should not only affirm that criticism, but you should say something like, you know, if you only knew me more, you would have far much worse to say than that. Like that, not only is that probably a good criticism of me, but it's only scratching the surface. And I think when you approach any criticism with that level of humility, which, I mean, let's be honest, is usually true. The worst things that people say about us are barely scratching the surface. If they could probe into our interior life, into our thoughts, into what really stirs our soul, they find much worse muck than whatever they're actually commenting on. So remembering that, I think, grounds you in a good humility.
Yeah. I'm going to try that with my oldest. He's 13 years old. So whenever he complains about people talking badly about it, I'm going to say, if only they really knew you, they could say way worse things.
But that's true. That's totally true.
He is terrified of anybody thinking poorly about him. He's at that perfect age, plus the way that he's wired. I think he would probably be crippled by that statement, though I would love for him to have that desire. We try to very gently kind of build that awareness in him. So one of my favorite things to just ask people is, what does a good day look like for you? For you, Brandon, what's one of the ways you would love to just spend 24 hours?
Oh, well, I'm a bibliophile, so I'm addicted to books. So a good day would probably involve 25 hours of reading good books. But I think realistically, a good day for me usually starts, I wake up on time. I don't sleep in past 6 or 6:30 because I'm kind of an early riser. Maybe do a little light workout in our little home gym / area. And then spending as much time as I can with my wife and my children. That's an ideal day for me. So Saturdays and Sundays are the best. I love my work. I love what I do, but nothing gives me more meaning and value in life than being with my family. So some combination of all that, doing, working out, keeping my body in shape, reading a bunch of good books, and spending time with family.
Awesome. What is something that fuels your creativity, and what's something that drains your creativity?
Good questions, Tony. I think what fuels it is the creativity of others. You know, there's the quote that all the best artists steal, that good art is stealing from others. And that doesn't mean plagiarizing or copying, but it means that many of the best artistic ideas through history have been derivations of other creative ideas. And that's certainly true for me. Whenever I'm writing, for instance, I spur my writing creativity by reading good writing from other authors, reading about similar topics and seeing how other people approach it from different angles. What drains my creativity? I think whenever my mind is stressed out from thinking about too many things, it's hard to be creative. So my most creative periods are unquestionably in the early mornings, maybe pushing around lunchtime. But after that, by the time I get into the afternoon or even the evening, my mind is so taxed through emails and work and stress about home projects and, you know, all sorts of little things that I just can't summon any creative thoughts. So I'd say those are probably what fuels me and what drains me.
Awesome. Have you read Austin Kleon's Steal Like an Artist and all the other books in that series?
I have, you know, and whenever it came out, I was tempted to steal it because I wanted to see what Austin would feel about that if I just stole it from the bookstore.
This is this great short little book called Steal Like an Artist. Austin does phenomenal work. He actually does, I don't remember what he actually calls it, but I'm going to call it like reduction poetry, where he blacks out words in books and in newspapers to write poetry based on other people's works. But he does this awesome series of reflections on what it means to borrow ideas from other people to create your own. And his follow-up book, Show Your Work, I think is just phenomenal also, too. So.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, going back to Austin's first book, one of the images that I printed out and I hung up for a while, I don't think I have it anymore, but it's a famous little work of art by Banksy. You know, Banksy's kind of the provocateur street artist in England, and he does all these sort of politically loaded bits of art. But he went and found a quote that was engraved in granite, and the quote said, the best artists steal, or all the best art is stealing, or something like that. And the person who gave the quote was Picasso. So it said, all the best artists steal, Picasso. And Banksy etched out Picasso's name, put a big X through it, and put Banksy's name. And so it was in a single work of art, the embodiment of what Austin Kleon is trying to get at.
That's awesome. I would love to just kind of pivot real quick into kind of the crux question that we ask here on The Threshold. And that is, if somebody came up to you on the street and just asked you in a minute or less to tell them what you believe, how would you respond to that question?
Oh, probably the first thing I'd say is, well, believe about what? Because I have millions of beliefs about an endless number of topics. But I imagine the question would probably have to be like, well, what are your deepest beliefs? You know, what are the convictions that drive you? And for me, I'd say a few things. First of all, I'm convinced that objective truth exists. If you can't get past that, you can't really get into much else. So I believe that there are certain truths in the world that are more than just subjective opinion. I don't believe that all of our beliefs are just subjective choices. Like, you know, I believe my favorite of ice cream is chocolate. You believe yours is vanilla. My favorite band is X. Your favorite band is Y. I believe that there are objective truths about the world. Second, I'd say that some of these objective truths, I'm convinced, are that God exists. I believe that Jesus of Nazareth is God, and I believe that Jesus started a church that has continued today through the Catholic Church. And so that's why I believe in Catholicism, because of those three facts. So that's probably how I'd start to answer some of these deeper conviction questions about what I believe.
Now, I know that you spend a lot of time talking to people about, you know, through Stranger Notions, through a lot of other work that you do, about that very question, what they believe, you know, is truth real? You know, does that truth represent that there's a God who created the universe and ordered it? When you dive into those conversations, what are some of the ways that you really feel like are the best way to engage people in those dialogues?
Well, I typically do a couple approaches. One is to approach any conversation like this with a spirit of friendly curiosity. You know, so when I'm talking with an atheist or an agnostic who probably believes very different things than I do, the first thing I want to do is ask him what he believes. I want to find out, you know, what he believes about the world, about truth, about God, about religion, about all these things. And what I've often found is just by asking simple questions like, well, what do you believe by X, or what do you mean by Y? You do a few things. First of all, you get clarity about what they believe. Second, it's a dignifying act because you're telling them implicitly, I care about what you believe. I care about you and your thoughts. I'm not here trying to just manipulate you or shove my opinions down your throat. I want to know where you're coming from. But then third, and I found this happens very often, many people accept lots of beliefs without good reason. And they've never really carefully thought through their beliefs to ask themselves, why do I really hold this belief? Is it something I just absorbed from my friends or my parents or the schools I went to? Or do I really have good reasons to support these beliefs? And so when you approach a conversation through friendly curiosity, you can bring to light some of these unexamined beliefs. So that's one approach I found very effective.
Awesome. And what's the response you typically get from that? I think for a lot of our listeners, a lot of people who are engaged in the threshold, that's something that they are interested in. That's a lot of what we spend our time doing here on the podcast. What do you typically see the response when you approach somebody that way as being?
Yeah, I think it depends on who I'm talking with. Some people have very carefully examined their beliefs. I don't mean to paint people with a broad brush, but I'd say in many, many cases, especially when we're talking about people in you're in my generation, you know, millennials, 20, 30 somethings, many of them, when you press just a little bit against their beliefs, very quickly you'll hear some version of, well, I don't know, I guess that's just what I believe. And to me, that's very problematic. If we don't have good reasons for our belief, then it means these beliefs really aren't grounded and anything substantial, that they're little more than just arbitrary opinion that maybe, again, we've absorbed from friends or family or teachers or schools or books or culture or whatever. And so I think that, like Socrates says, the unexamined life is not worth living. Mm-hmm. We should examine what we believe, question what we believe, and follow the truth and the evidence wherever it takes us.
I would love to hear from you a little bit more about kind of how you got to this place, how you got to this place of your current beliefs. And you've already identified, you know, I think pretty clearly that you are a Roman Catholic, right?
That's right.
Tell me a little bit more about that journey. You noted a couple different groups that you matriculated through, but what was your faith life like at home growing up?
Good question. So I was raised in a pretty typical suburban family. So my family went to church each Sunday. We were mildly involved with this Presbyterian Protestant church that I was a part of. But for us, religion was kind of nominal. It was, you know, it was just something our family did. But growing up as a kid, it never really connected with me. I would never have said, you know, that I had personally met Jesus Christ or I had a deep personal faith. It, for me, it was kind of just going through the motions. And so by the time I got to college, I was at a pivotal point where I could have took the path that many of my peers take when they kind of just shrug off religion by the time they get to college. And that's kind of the end of it. Or they could more intentionally explore it and move deeper into it. And it's the latter path that I ended up taking. I got involved with a Methodist campus ministry at Florida State University, and I got connected with a group of guys who took me under their wing, who started teaching me about the Bible, about God, about prayer. There was this extremely warm community that I was sort of pulled into, and all of those things kind of reawakened this personal sense of faith. I started reading the Bible on my own, which I never would have done growing up. And when I did, specifically reading through the four Gospels, I was just captivated by the person of Jesus. He was nothing like the sort of fabricated, defanged, domesticated, felt board Jesus that I had, you know, experienced growing up. He was provocative. He was dangerous. He was revolutionary. He was intriguing, beguiling. The person of Jesus just captivated me. And then finally, from there, when I started looking into the resurrection, I quickly became convinced that either the resurrection is true, and therefore, you know, I need to be a serious Christian, because that means that God has conquered death, and that what the Bible says about Jesus is true. It vindicates all of Jesus's claims. Or it's not true. It's either a myth or a legend, or it can be explained away through a mass hallucination or something to that effect. And in that case, Christianity is just the biggest farce around. You know, I should get as far away from it as I could. And after many months of study and rigorous research, I became convinced that the resurrection is a historical fact. So that led me to become a deeply committed Christian with a thriving personal faith. It wasn't until a couple of years later that I started looking into the Catholic Church. So at the time, I was just a Methodist, which was one version of Protestant Christianity. But I was preparing to marry my now wife, who was born and raised Catholic. And so the religion question naturally came up. What are we going to do? Are we going to go to two different churches? How are we going to make this work out? And it was then that I realized I didn't know anything about Catholicism. She was kind of the only openly Catholic person I knew. So I thought, out of respect and love for her, I should at least look into this. So I began reading all sorts of Catholic books. I began talking with Catholics. I began interacting with Catholics online and posing my many, many, many objections and criticisms. And over time, I began to see that the Catholic Church makes a very rational and coherent proposal. Unlike my Protestant faith, which the more I dug into it, the less sense it made. Catholicism was just the opposite. The more I dug into it, the more sense it made. Specifically, I became convinced that all the Protestant churches I've been part of, like the Presbyterian Church and the Methodist Church, were fairly recent and novel innovations. These are churches that were started by men, very specific men. We know who started them: John Knox for Presbyterianism and John Wesley for Methodism. And they started, I mean, no more than 500 years ago, even a couple hundred years ago here in a few cases. But the Catholic Church says that this is the church Jesus established back when he was still walking the earth. And it's the church that he gave his own authority to teach and act in his name. That's a very unique and provocative claim. And the more I looked into that, the more I became convinced it was true. So that's, in a nutshell, how I ended up becoming Catholic. First, I became convinced that Jesus was God because he rose from the dead. And then I became convinced that Jesus established not 30,000 different churches, but one church, and that church is the Catholic Church. So I knew if I wanted to follow Jesus, then that's the church I needed to be a part of.
Mm. What is, and I know you said it was months of research, so I'm going to ask you to do something hard. Out of those months of research, what was one of the key things that really convinced or convicted you that Jesus had actually risen from the dead?
Well, I think what convicted me is that the resurrection hypothesis is the best accounting of all of the historical evidence. So very quickly, there are five historical facts that nearly every biblical scholar agrees on. And I don't just mean Christian biblical scholars. I mean, even atheists and agnostic scholars. There's a near consensus about these five facts. First of all, Jesus of Nazareth was crucified and was killed on a cross. Second, he was buried honorably in a tomb. And we know the person who owned that tomb, Joseph of Arimathea, who's a historical figure. Third, a few days after he was buried, his tomb was discovered empty. Fourth, many people, including enemies, claimed to have seen and interacted with Jesus after his tomb was discovered empty. And fifth and finally, there was a sudden and remarkable transformation among his closest followers, the 12 disciples, after his death. They went from being afraid and defeated to suddenly bold, courageous, and careening around the world proclaiming that Jesus had risen from the dead. So again, these are five historical facts that almost every biblical scholar agrees on. Now, they differ about how to explain those facts. What's the best theory that accounts for this evidence? So some of them, for example, will suggest that, well, what really happened in the first century was, you know, Jesus was killed, he was buried, but then there was just a mass hallucination that people thought they saw Jesus, but they were really just deluded. However, that fails to account for several key pieces of evidence, such as the empty tomb. If it was a mass hallucination, where's Jesus's body? Also, we know that the appearances that these people claim to have experienced were physical in nature. They claim to have touched Jesus. They claim to have eaten with him. So these aren't just sort of spiritual, mystical experiences. So that mass hallucination theory didn't work for me. Then there was the swoon theory that said, well, maybe Jesus just sort of fell asleep on the cross. It looked like he was dead, but he really wasn't. This is actually what Muslims believe. If you read the Quran, it says that Jesus appeared to be crucified, but he was not. So they believe that he really didn't die on the cross. And therefore, whenever he emerges from the tomb, it's not really a resurrection. He's just sort of being resuscitated from this bloody torture. But again, I don't think that accounts for many of the facts. I mean, if you know anything about Roman crucifixion, you would know that if anybody survived it, then the centurions responsible for the crucifixion would have been put to death themselves. So they're experts in dealing out death, and they were incentivized to make sure Jesus died. But then, of course, even after being lashed and whipped and nailed to a cross and beaten to a bloody pulp, if you saw this guy 3 days later, you're, you know, maybe if he's lucky being able to stand up and hobble out of his tomb, the last thing you would say is, wow, here's the Lord of life who's come back from the dead and has defeated death. You know, you would say, you get this man to a hospital as quick as we can, right? Mm-hmm. So none of these theories made sense of those five facts. What I found was that there's only one plausible theory that accounts comprehensively for all five of these facts, and that's the hypothesis that Jesus rose from the dead. So that's what convinced me of the resurrection.
Thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate it. That's a really great, concise example of why you believe, which, again, I wish more people were able to. And what I really love, Brandon, is that it really backs up a lot of what you started your belief with, right? You weren't just like, well, I believe it's true, and therefore, because I've experienced it, which is something I desire for people. We'll talk about that in a minute. But since one of your primary beliefs was that truth exists, being able to go to this place of here's the historical facts, I can really see why that resonated with you. And I think that's something that really is a huge challenge for a lot of people, is they don't see anything about most people's faith as being factual so much as just personal. So thanks so much for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you. And it's important to make this distinction between knowing your faith is true and showing your faith is true, because, you know, there are millions and millions of Catholics, for example, who know that God exists or know that Jesus is God. And they know this through a variety of ways. Maybe it's through a personal experience or an encounter. Maybe it's through a profound spiritual moment. Maybe they just intuit that God or Jesus is real. And those are not bad ways to know that something is real. We shouldn't discount those. The problem is they're ultimately subjective. They're unknowable to other people. And so if you want to show other people that your belief is true and that they should consider it too, you need to provide objective reasons. And that's what I was on the hunt for as a college student, because I had had personal, profound spiritual experiences with God in prayer and through reading the Bible and through this community of other Christians, that I was mostly convinced that Christianity was true. But that wasn't enough for me. You know, I was being trained as a mechanical engineer. I was studying mathematics and modern physics. I wanted evidence. I wanted reason. And so I needed something to back that up and reaffirm it. And so that's when I engaged this long study of the historical evidence for Christianity.
Yeah, that's great. What was one of the biggest stumbling blocks for you in your search for Catholicism? What was one of the things that really took you the longest to either come around to or get the evidence you were looking for to help you really overcome the objections you had?
Great question, Tony. I know the exact answer, because very early on when I was looking into the Catholic Church, I was almost ready to give up because, and this might sound bad to say, but I was put off by Catholics. So the biggest argument for me against Catholicism was Catholics. And many people have made that same sort of observation. G.K. Chesterton, a great Catholic convert and writer, says the biggest argument against Christianity is Christians. And it's true. It's true. You know, I encountered lots of Catholics, not any who were mean or who were vulgar, vitriolic, but I just sensed when I walked into a Catholic church this sort of deadened spirit, and I thought, I don't want to, if that's all Catholicism is, then it's not worth it for me. You know, if Catholicism just means showing up for a boring religious service on a Sunday and just reciting some words out of rote memory and, you know, and having no real invigoration or personal effect, what's the point? You know, if it has no impact on your life, if it's completely irrelevant to the way you live your life, then it's not worth exploring. So that really was a stumbling block for me. What changed was discovering good Catholics, and particularly the saints. So the saints are those who best live out the Catholic faith. You know, I once heard the metaphor that suppose you had a doctor who had some potentially life-saving medicine. It was a new cure for, say, cancer. And there were 10 patients who approached him, and he prescribed that all 10 of these patients take this medicine because it will save your life. It will get rid of the cancer. Well, then suppose that a few weeks later you find out that 9 of the patients never took the medicine, yet they critique the doctor because their cancer still exists. What would we say? Well, we'd say, you know, you can't critique somebody for prescribing a cure, but then the people don't take the cure. That you shouldn't judge the quality of the cure on by the people who don't take it. You should judge it by the one person who took the cure, who took the medicine and was cured. And that, I think, is a good analogy for what I found with the Catholic Church. I was judging the Catholic Church based on lots and lots of people who don't really live out what the Catholic Church proposes. The Catholic Church offers these many great gifts and this great wisdom and spiritual tradition, but many people, even within the church, sort of just ignore that. But those are the people I was judging the church by. Instead, I realized I should judge the church based on its best members. I should judge it by those who took the church's cure, and those people we call the saints. So people like Mother Teresa or John Paul II or Damien of Molokai, who willingly went and served in a leper colony, even though he knew it would meant that he would get leprosy and be killed from the disease himself. I mean, these were the people that set me on fire for the Catholic faith and helped me to overcome that obstacle.
So your favorite Catholics are dead Catholics.
Well, I would say they're not dead, but yes, they're dead on earth, but alive in Christ.
I think that's huge. I think that really is a great counterpoint to your journey through truth, is the fact that there was this very personal element to how you overcame those objections and how you engaged within the life of these people who are no longer with us here on earth, but we as Catholics believe are alive in heaven, and how that touched you. That's so great to hear that journey for you. So thank you so much for sharing that. I do want to talk a little bit about the work you do now, because you are somebody who does work that I just always am continually blown away by. I know there are people out there who are amazed at the amount of things you are able to accomplish within the course of any given day, even if you may not feel that way, and just the continual work that you do. You write books, you run Strange Notions. You run the Word on Fire content stuff. You do all these different things. You did the Return series a little while ago that we did at my parish. And you've got Claritas U going now. All these different things that you are doing that just seem to always be done with excellence. And I think I just want to know not only why you do that, which I do want to know, and just kind of hear from you some of the things that have drawn you to each of the different projects you work on, or maybe one or two, but how you do that. I mean, it's just such a consistent example of somebody, in my opinion, executing things incredibly well with deep passion and high quality. And I just am always blown away by what you're doing. So I'd love to talk a little bit about those two things, why you are motivated to do some of your favorite projects, and then kind of what your process looks like for pursuing those, because I think that's just deeply attractive to me. So whether anybody listening wants to hear it or not, I want to know. So what are some of your favorite favorite pieces of work that you have been able to do? What are some of the things that you've done that you are most excited about or most proud of?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for all those kind words, Tony. That's extremely generous of you. I'll answer each of those questions in turn. So first of all, why do I do what I do? You know, after I became a Christian, my life changed in many profound ways. Or after, I should say, after I became a serious, committed Christian, one of the ways it changed was I had a renewed sense of mission, of purpose. I felt like I wasn't just here by biological accident. You know, I was here. I was created with a specific purpose by God. God has given me specific gifts and has given me a certain direction in my life because he has things that he wants to accomplish through me. So that's been a motivating factor ever since. You know, I'm constantly asking God in prayer, what do you want me to do? What's next? What's the next thing I'm supposed to be doing to forward your mission, Lord? And inevitably, I mean, I've never heard God's voice audibly, but inevitably through senses, through promptings, through intuition, through the advice of friends, the counsel of mentors, inevitably, whatever needs to be done tends to take some form of what am I really good at and what does the world really need? You know, there's a great line from Frederick Buechner, one of my favorite authors. He says that your calling is that place where your gifts and the world's great hunger meet. Mm-hmm. I think that's dead right. You know, what special things and gifts have I been created with? And where's the hole in the culture that needs something that those gifts could be applied to? So that's kind of how I've come up with each of the projects I've worked on and put out. So for example, Strange Notions, we mentioned that one already. I found that there was a huge gap in serious-minded, fruitful dialogue between atheists and believers. That if you visit any atheist blog or website, or if you visit any Christian blog or website that talks about atheism, you'll inevitably find an incessant stream of vitriol. You know, mm-hmm. It'll be mostly mockery, sarcasm on both sides, Yeah. So I don't want to let my fellow Christians off the hook here. It's a big problem. And so I wanted to create sort of an oasis online where people could have charitable, fruitful discussion about these things. And at the time, you know, I happened to be very well read in those areas. I had lots of friends and scholars and theologians and philosophers who I was already connected with, who I could invite to contribute to the site. And I had a decent background in web design and development and social media stuff. So all of the gifts that I had been given were uniquely positioned to make something like this successful. So that's how I came up with that project. And then similar story with my other stuff. My most recent book was titled Return, How to Draw Your Child Back to the Church. And it's a similar story. You know, I've been working in this ministry of helping young people come back to the church when at the same time, this is one of the biggest felt needs, one of the biggest problems in the church today, that parents and grandparents are seeing their children or grandchildren drift away from the church and they don't know what to do about it. So I put together a resource to help and people really responded well to it. So that's how I'd answer that first question about why I do what I do. Now, how do I get all that done? You used one word there that was really important to me, and it's execution. Lots of people have good ideas. You know, ideas are a dime a dozen. Few people execute those ideas well because execution is hard. It requires discipline. And one thing I've learned in my life is that execution requires you to say no a lot more times than you say yes. Mm-hmm. So for every project I'm working on, I have to say no to 50 other really cool and exciting and intriguing projects that would be alternative. So maybe they're working with other people. Maybe it's other ideas that I have that I think would make for a really good book or project. But in order to execute the specific project I'm working on, I have to say no to a lot of good things. So that's a key to how I'm able to get a lot done, is I'm very intentionally focused on just one or two things at a time and focused on making those things really, really good. And then finally, your last question, what are some of my favorite projects? We've mentioned a couple of them already. Strange Notions, my Return project, which was a book and video course on how to help young people come back to the church and come to faith. And then my newest one is a online membership site for Catholics called Claritas U. So Claritas is the Latin word for clarity. And that's what the whole site's about. It's about helping Catholics get clear about what they believe, especially about difficult topics, so that they can discuss those topics with others. So we've got about 3,000 people who are part of the community now. It's really vibrant and exciting, and I think is bearing a lot of fruit. So that's how I'd answer those three questions.
Yeah, that's awesome. Did you get any pushback from the Scientology community on the Claritas U going clear concept?
No, and I didn't even think about that till right now. You know, maybe I need to create a Scientology spinoff site and offer it to them.
No, I love hearing that. I experienced this with you. That was one of my favorite things about it. When I reached out to you for this interview, which it's good to know you said no to 50 other interviews and said yes to this one. You know, I asked you three questions, you know, and you were very clear, like, yes, I can commit to this one. Maybe I can do this one. Let me think about it and get back to you. No, I can't do this because I won't have the time to do it and I can't commit to it. And having that up front as somebody who's seeking interviews is really good. The worst thing is no response, like getting a no. It's kind of like, okay, well, I move on, you know, like, or I'll come back, you know, it's fine. But getting no response actually then leaves me hanging on, okay, yes, how should I follow up? What should I do? And so just getting clarity on each of those things from the get-go is real. So I do want to point out, like, I have experienced that with you, and it actually from the receiving end is very refreshing also too.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. And I'll add this too, because this was really hard for me to learn. As soon as I realized I need to start saying no a lot more often, you know, I'm a people pleaser like most of us are. And so I was terrified about what my friends and peers would think if I said no when they asked me to, you know, partner with them or help them out or, you know, do X, Y, or Z. But what I found is just the opposite, that when you tell people no and then explain why, say, you know, that sounds like a really cool thing. I wish I could be a part of it, but unfortunately I can't because I'm juggling a full-time job. I've got 6 kids and I'm working on these other couple side projects. So I need to be devoted to those things. When you explain to people why you're saying no, it inevitably they'll be positive in response. You know, I've had people even say to me, wow, that's awesome. I really respect that, you know, you're saying no, even though this was a good opportunity for you. I respect that you're focusing on the first things in your life, you know, your family, your job, your own side project. So thanks for letting me know that. So to anybody here who's worried about what would happen if you say no to good things in order to free up time for the really great things, just realize that most people are positively responsive whenever you explain why you're saying no.
Yeah, that's been my experience also too. I mean, as disappointed as somebody might be, once you can tell them why, it's deeply satisfying for them. It actually frees them up a whole lot. Since we don't say no, you talked about people being people pleasers. People aren't taught to say no. Young people aren't taught to say no. Yeah. I mean, they may say it to parents all the time. My kids tell me no regularly, but the reality is they're not coached to do that to other people because they don't have a sense of priority, of highest order and what's most important. Yes. A lot of times we've broadened our lives out a whole lot. So returning to that is deeply challenging. I want to step back for a second just to a couple questions I would love for people who are listening to be able to hear from you. And we talked a lot about how kind of the person of Christ you read about in scripture impacted you, how it was very different from the Christ that had been kind of presented to you on felt boards, you know, in a Presbyterian, you know, faith formation setting. But what about your personal experiences with Christ? Have you ever had a moment that you would identify as a moment of encounter with Jesus? Or do you feel like you have a personal relationship with him?
Yes, I'd say an emphatic yes to both of those two questions. The first important encounter that I had with Jesus, I remember the exact moment. It was Easter of 2007. So I was a junior in college. And by this time I had been reading the Gospels. I had become sort of captivated by Jesus as a literary person, you know, this figure that I was reading about in the Bibles. But then I went to this Easter service at this Methodist church I was a part of. And there was a culmination of things that I think led to this moment. You know, we were singing praise and worship songs. There was a very strong and appointed teaching from the pastor there. I had been, again, preparing myself for months by reading through the Gospels. But that night, when I closed my eyes and I prayed, I just felt this overwhelming sense of being in communion with this living person who I recognized as Jesus. It was the first time when I could really say, I know Jesus in a way more than just knowing about him through the Bible. Like, I know him. He's in my heart. And that experience was something that was never replicated. I never could sort of force myself or bring myself into that same place again. And so much of my Christian life since then has been sort of built on that foundation, but it was an extremely impactful moment for me. Now, since then, once I became Catholic, I've had a couple other similar experiences. One of them was the night that I became Catholic, which was exactly, now that I think about it, I never made this connection. It was exactly 1 year later because it was Easter of 2008 when I entered the Catholic Church. And it was the first time when I was able to receive communion or the Eucharist in the Catholic Church. And as Catholics, the Catholic Church teaches that the Eucharist is the body and blood of Jesus, even though it retains the accidents or the material qualities of bread and wine. So even though it looks like bread, it smells like bread, it tastes like bread, at the level of substance or what it essentially is, it's the body and blood of Jesus. It's not just a symbol, not just a sign. It is Jesus Christ. So when you receive communion, you're consuming Jesus. You're uniting your body with his. And so the very first night when I received communion, the first mass that I was partaking in as a Catholic, I remember I received the Blessed Sacrament, the Eucharist. I went back to the pew, I kneeled down, and just bubbling up from deep inside me were tears of utter joy. And I am not a crying person. I don't cry at movies. I'm very controlled in my emotions, but I just wept. And it was this sense that I'm communing with a real person. It wasn't just, you know, I ate this piece of bread and I try to remember about Jesus. It was, I'm in communion now with the living God. And so those are probably the two most profound encounters that I've had with Jesus.
So if you had to name kind of the effect of that in you on a personal level, could you name what change that's affected in your personal life?
Yes, it convinced me that Jesus was real and that I could have a relationship with him. You know, it's one thing to believe, as I did before these two experiences, that Jesus is an interesting person that I should try to model my life after. It's another thing to say Jesus is still alive today, that he's not a dead man who died on a cross 2,000 years ago, but that he's still alive in heaven, albeit, and that we can interact with him through prayer. And so it's totally revolutionized my life because now I pray every day. I enter to communion with Jesus. I speak to him and I try to listen to him. Again, not audibly. I don't hear Jesus's voice in my head or in my ears, but through senses and promptings, through reading the words of Jesus in scripture, through other means, I'm able to interact with him in a relationship. So it profoundly changed my life.
Tell me a little bit more about your prayer life. What does that look like for you?
Well, it's changed a lot over the years. I'm a very scatterbrained, probably quasi ADD type of person. So I have a real difficulty of sitting down and meditating or contemplating for a long time. But in recent months, I have been able to commit to a 30-minute slot at the beginning of the day at 7 a.m. So from 7 a.m. to 7:30 a.m., I park my bottom in a chair and I commit to just being there, whatever ends up happening. And I kind of cycle through several different devotions or styles during this 30 minutes. So part of the time I try to read the Bible, specifically the New Testament and more specifically the Gospels. I try to pray different classical Catholic prayers that have proven to lead people closer to God throughout the centuries. So these would include things like the Rosary prayer, the Jesus prayer, the Our Father prayer, things like that. I read spiritual literature and reflect on it. So I read the writings of the saints, the different writings from popes, different other spiritual masters, and read small chunks of it and then pray. And then I always try to end with just a period of quiet contemplation and listening, where I sort of ask God, what are you trying to say to me? What are you trying to do in my life? You know, what is all this stuff I just took in, this reading or this reflection? You know, how does it affect my day-to-day life? What do you want of me today, Lord? So that's what it looks like. I take a pretty ad hoc approach where I'm not, you know, rigorously committed to one particular style of prayer, but I try to change it up and keep things fresh because there are infinite number of ways you can come to interact with God.
And you do a lot of, I'm going to assume based on what I know about your character, you probably do a good amount of spiritual reading. Is there a book that, if you had to name a book besides the Bible or the Catechism or something somebody might expect that's impacted your spiritual life, what's been one of the most impactful books that you've ever read for your spirituality?
Yes. Yes, good question, Tony. The number one book that's affected me is a book titled To Know Christ Jesus. It's by Frank Sheed. Frank Sheed was a kind of a high-level intellect in English society in the mid to late 20th century, and he ran a publishing house called Sheed and Ward, which was one of the big publishing houses in the world. And he's, I believe, a convert to Catholicism. Don't quote me on that, but he wrote several books, but this one is maybe the most profound Catholic spiritual book I've ever read, because what it does is it moves through the life of Jesus. So it in some ways tracks the same narrative that you'll find in the four Gospels, but with a different aim than what the Gospels ostensibly try to do. The Gospels are trying to introduce you to this person of Jesus and recount the historical events of his life and teaching. But Frank Sheed's book is aiming to tell a similar narrative, but instead help you to, as the title suggests, know Christ Jesus, to know him as a person. So for example, if I was writing a book about how to know Tony Vicenda, you know, you could do just a straight biography where I say, oh, well, he was born here, he's worked there, now he lives in Seattle, this is what he does day to day. But if I was writing a book about how to know Tony Vicenda, I would try to approach you from a much deeper, more visceral, existential level. I would try to connect readers to you at the level of the heart, at the level of the spirit. And that's what Frank Sheed does in this book. It's hard for me to describe it, but the quality of the writing and the effect that it had on me was immediate and lasts to this day. Mm-hmm. After finishing that book, I thought, yeah, I know Jesus now. I don't just know about him. I know him person to person, just as I would know a close friend or family member. Mm. So that's one book I'd recommend, especially to someone who's interested in Christianity, maybe sort of just gazing on it from the outside, but wants to know what it's like on the inside. That'd be a good place to start.
Yeah, thanks. And we'll link, just so everybody knows, we'll link to all these books down in the show notes. So if you are interested in following up any of those, I'll go dig around the internet and find out where they're at for you and make sure that you can get to those, as well as a lot of the other things Brandon has talked about. Brandon, at the end of each conversation, I just offer a couple things to people before we close. And that's one, is there, if there's anything you'd like to ask me, I take away a lot from these conversations and I am always, you know, excited to be able to offer something in return, but I don't have anything specific. So if you have a question you'd like to ask me, I'm more than happy to answer it.
No, I'm just curious. You might have talked about this maybe on an earlier episode, but I'd like to know what the impetus was for this great podcast. How did it come about? What were your thoughts behind it?
Yeah, so there's a longer version of it on our Zero episode, which you should only listen to the first half of because the last half is really bad audio. But no, I mean, I don't expect that a lot of people will go back and do that. So, you know, at its very core, you know, my method of teaching is very Socratic. And I really love asking questions. I really love sitting down with people and hearing about what they think and what they believe. And since moving to Seattle, it's something I've gotten to do more than any other time in my life. In Texas, people are very culturally Christian, and it's more about affiliation than it is about belief and understanding. Where do you attend church on Sunday? Not so much how does that faith define your life? You know, people in Seattle, not the same. Not the same at all.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite experiences, which I don't know if I've ever talked about, was shortly after moving up here, I was at this board game pub. It was its opening weekend. I was really excited about it. It's basically a place to sit down, play board games, drink beer, eat ice cream, hang out. And I...
That sounds like heaven, I think is what they
right? Yeah, absolutely. And so it was just, you know, people were just picking up and doing, you know, random play with other people in the packed building. And so these guys came up and said, hey, we're going to play this game over here. Do you want to play with us? And says, sure. I sat down, started playing with us. Soon enough, we're just in the chit chat around things and going around the circle. And this guy who is goes, you know, so what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a youth worker, because I'm always a little bit like, you know, subtle about it, just to kind of, you know, see where people are at. They said, oh, well, what does that mean? I said, I work with the Catholic Church and I work with high schoolers and middle school students, which is what I did at that time. And I also travel around a little bit and talk about it. And they asked me a really interesting thing. They said, oh, that's, I was raised pagan, which in my experience, people aren't raised pagan. Like in Texas, people just got really angsty as teenagers and became pagan. And so I was kind of surprised by that. And so, but he said, the question he asked me was, can you tell me about the ashes on the forehead? And I said,
okay.
I said, sure. He said, that's a thing you guys do, right? And I said, yeah. He said, we do it on Ash Wednesday. You know, it's leading into this time of, you know, reflection on the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, specifically the death and resurrection, which is core to our belief. And kind of, it's a sign of penance, but it's this understanding of kind of conforming ourselves to this time of the season. I give him this basic explanation, you know, over a couple minutes of Lent and Easter, and basically was able to do some basic gospel proclamation to him. And he goes, that's so powerful. But he then was able to, after asking me questions, you know, I was able to return, you know, so what defines your faith? And it was the first time I'd ever talked with somebody who wasn't an atheist or another form of Christian, but who had been raised in a dramatically different lifestyle than I had, religiosity. And really, he was a polytheist. He wasn't a pagan. He wasn't Wiccan. He didn't have a specific way of practicing that. And so it was really interesting to kind of dive into it with him and have him kind of come to that same thing that you talked about at the very beginning of, well, it's just kind of what I was taught. You know, it's just kind of what I believe. I don't necessarily have reasons for it. But it was just a really life-giving conversation. And it wasn't at the end like, you know, I prayed over him and he converted. He didn't start coming to Mass, but he did say, hey, do you want to come back to my house? Unfortunately, I had to get home, but he was, you know, they were going to play board games somewhere else and in their home and invited me to come along with them. And we, you know, we still see each other from time to time. We still have some of those conversations. We're still in relationship with each other, but it really was one of the most life-giving things I've ever done. And so since then, I've started having more and more of those conversations. And as Sherry Waddell's book, Forming Intentional Disciples, came out and she talked about threshold conversations, I realized that's what I had been doing with these people over and over and over again. And so as I finally got to a point where I was like, I really want to develop a podcast or two, it was one of the first things I wanted to really dive into, because I think it's one of the hardest things in our culture is that people think that, you know, as much as we say don't talk about politics and religion, people are happy to share their politics with you. They do so with great passion and zeal. But for especially those of us who are Catholic, people are very ill-equipped to talk about their faith. And so this is really just my way of showing people how not only healthy these conversations are, how good they are, but how beautiful they are, and how great when we're able to find these moments of deep truth, right? These this kind of seeds of the word in people's lives, how much and how life-giving that is for us as Catholics. And so I am, that's why I do it.
That's beautiful. Thanks for sharing that.
And then my other question is would you like to pray together?
Sure.
Now let's begin in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Lord God, but we just thank you for Brandon. We just thank you for the work that you're doing through him. But God, we also just thank you for ordering the universe around truth, for placing yourself, the person who is truth, in the midst of all of these things and ordering them all to yourselves. And for people out there who don't experience you as truth, I would hope that the truth that they experience in their life leads them closer to you. And I thank you for the way that Brandon lives that as an example in his personal life, the way he's forming his family in that, and the way that he orders his projects around not just the truth of who you are in his life, but the way that you've revealed himself across history and across creation. We ask you to bless us and keep us. Amen.
Amen.
The Father and the Son, Holy Spirit. Brandon, thanks so much for being on here. Now, I do know you have a new book that is out that we were talking about right before we started that I'm going to go check out this weekend. But could you tell folks a little bit about it?
Sure. The book is titled Why I Am Catholic and You Should Be Too. So it's got that sort of provocative subtitle there. It just came out. You can find it at whycatholicbook.com or any good bookstore or bad bookstore, I suppose.
And if people want to connect with you or follow your work, what is the best way to do that?
The best way is probably go to BrandonVogt.com, which is just my name, Brandon Vogt, VOGT.com. And that's where I have my blog, list of my different books and more. So BrandonVogt.com.
And then one final question. What is the best mispronunciation of your last name you've ever gotten?
Oh, there's Vogt, Voigt, Vogt. That probably is pretty exhaustive, but I'd say only about 20% of the time is it correctly pronounced. So you're already like well ahead of the curve, Tony.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Well, I will be back after a short break here to sit down with my good friend, Father Colin Parrish, and talk a little bit about what we took away from this conversation that I had with Brandon. I hope we'll have you back with us right after that break. Hey guys, before we head into the wrap-up interview with Father Colin Parrish, I wanted to take just a minute to announce our winner from this week's iTunes rating and reviewing giveaway. If you rate or review the Threshold podcast on iTunes with a 5-star rating and leave us some feedback, you are going to get entered into a chance to win some great products from CatholicBalm.co. It's things like beard balm, lip balm, lotion bars, some amazing things that are everyday reminders of our universal call to holiness. And we're really excited to announce this week's winner is a reviewer named MLOC. You're one of our Canadian listeners. Thank you so much for your review, your feedback, your kind words. We really appreciate it. So if you would like to win some great things from Catholic Balm Co., please go online and rate and review us in the iTunes store. If you leave a 5-star rating and some feedback, you'll get entered into a chance to win. Even if you did it a couple weeks ago, you're still in the running if you haven't won yet. And now with the new iTunes updates, it's even easier to rate and review a podcast straight from the show page in your iPod viewer. If you're rating and reviewing other places, that helps, but the iTunes ones are the ones we check. I also want to send a shout out to Bryce Comfort. Bryce is our newest patron on Patreon. He's also the first person who just discovered the show and decided to show us some support. But we want to thank Sherry, Melissa, Susan, all of our other patrons. But Bryce Comfort, thank you so much for your support. And we have some great stuff coming out on Patreon next month for all of those people who are supporting the show. If you want to check that out, it's at patreon.com/thethresholdpodcast, or you can just go to thethresholdpodcast.fm. That's thresholdpodcast.fm, and click the support tab. Anyways, in just 1 minute, we'll be back with my interview with Father Colin Parrish, where we'll talk about what we took away from my conversation with Brandon. Hey buddy, how's it going?
Good. It's a good day. Sounds like it, doesn't it? Oops.
It's so good today. How was school today?
School was good. The kids are teenagers, complex and simple at the same time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Were you complex and simple as a teenager?
Yes.
Yeah. You do anything fun today?
I said mass for them. That was good. I actually used the Office of Readings from yesterday as my morning reflection from Augustine.
And the Office of Readings is?
Office of Readings is part of the Liturgy of the Hours, which is a selection of prayers of the Psalms that are in a 4-week cycle that priests and religious, who are in like monasteries or convents or friaries, et cetera, pray on a 4-week basis in a cycle. And so they pray them 7 times a day, depending on their constitutions. I pray them 5 times a day because of my constitutions with my bishop.
Yeah. Constitutions being like agreements and rules mm-hmm. and regulations, right? Not like you've started your own country.
I did.
You start your own country.
Yeah.
So you were telling me right before we started that you got did an open Q&A with one of the classrooms mm-hmm. and that you got some interesting questions. Can you give people a sampling of those questions?
Yeah, actually, I didn't tell you all of them either. They were hilarious. One was, by the way, your children are coming home.
That's fine. I'll lock the door.
So it was ranging from questions of why can't priests get married? Good question. To... what's the hair product that I use? To do I trim my eyebrows, which was hilarious to me.
Do you trim your eyebrows?
No, they're just there.
That's just they just grow kind of uniformly like that.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
And then the when Tony says uniformly, he means they're actually perfect squares.
Yeah. absolutely.
I'm actually a cartoon character. And then I got one that was. On the basis of how come God sometimes, only sometimes speaks and sometimes not at all.
Mm.
And I was like, that's a great question. And then finally I got one that said, can trans men, become priests? And so I decided now these were all on like slips. So I was able to choose which ones I was going to address. And I just kind of at the spur of a moment, I just kind of feeling it, prayed real quick. And I says, screw it. I'll just go for it.
Yeah.
So
you told him what hair products you use?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That's cool. That's awesome. We actually are looking at a couple interviews in the future where that's going to come up. So maybe we'll revisit that question and what it might look like. Maybe we won't either. I don't know. We'll see. We'll Who see. Knows what the future holds. But in the meantime, did you have a chance to listen to Brandon's episode?
Of course.
What did you take away from that?
So, okay. First thing is, so as the listeners know that... who are Catholic listeners who are Catholic, it's easier to be more, it's easier to make finer distinctions when it comes to Catholics when you are one.
Right.
And the other thing was that I was able to kind of really just take in Brandon's, I don't know, just affect. I was really pleased by it, but it was interesting seeing the distinctions of his character of Catholicism, what his own personality brings to the table as far as faith is concerned. And I was really intrigued by that because for me, I think it's interesting when I see like engineers who are Catholic in particular, because Brandon said that he went to Florida University. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some, I can't remember what university it was.
He lives in the armpit of the world. I mean, Florida. So, you mm-hmm. know,
that's true. So
one of those universities there.
And so it was interesting that it's just hilarious to see how differently he thinks from me. He thinks in a very linear fashion. Anybody who knows me knows that I do not think linear in a linear fashion.
Yeah, I gave a dig about that in a talk the other night at the parish. And I told you this already, but no one laughed. Like I was like, yeah. And then when Father Parrish loses the plot line in his homily and like I thought it was just like a fun sideways dig at a friend. Apparently only 3 people who laughed very loud while everybody else just looked on in awestruck horror did not understand that it was just meant in jest, but also happens.
So I was really pleased by his in his linear logical fashion, right? And he's not coming off as propositional either. Hmm. Like propositional in a negative sense, right? Like people who make faith into a series of propositional tenets that add up into a certain conclusion, therefore X, right? And he hinted at the more mystical side of his experience. Well, hinted at, he went in full blown into that, into one experience that he had that was very definitive for him. And so what I really was really a kind of affirmed by was the fact that like different personalities within the church, Christ like really affirms those personalities and uses them well, right? He really communicates himself through those different personalities. So where I don't feel any disconnect from Brandon because he's an engineering kind of mentality
right.
about life. I feel like I can have connection with him in that way, or because how Christ communicates himself through Brandon's personality. And I love that. That was great.
Yeah, I am. That's one of the things I love. I think a lot of people out there have this perception of there's one way to be Catholic, or there's one type of Catholic, or they even may have a perception of like, hey, there's some different spiritual types and traditions in the Catholic Church. And so maybe there's like Franciscan temperament, Ignatian temperament, like all these other things. Mm-hmm. I don't think people realize that if there's, you know, there's a billion Catholics, there's actually like a billion different ways that people experience their relationship with Jesus and
yeah.
their faith. And so,
Exactly. Broad categorizations aside, right, that every person's relationship with the mystery is going to be unique.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So within that conversation, like, what did you think about his experience of coming to know Christ as this person who really lived, mm-hmm. who really died, and kind of his exploration of like why he thought it was true? Did you have a moment like that where you were really confronted with, do I actually believe this guy existed?
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing.
You got to step back again.
Sorry.
We're on a new microphone setup, so we're learning the ins and outs of it. But yeah, you got to be in front of it.
So here's the thing that was interesting to me, because he was speaking to some different experiences that I've been having lately. My personality is, I'm not a dumb guy. Like, I have a very sharp intellect, and my intellect is good about grasping a circumstance. However, if you're going to, for insider speak, I have a mentality, I have a brain kind of like JP2 versus Ratzinger, for example. So that being said though, one of the things that I've also been experiencing has been like helping people come to understand, you know, the necessity of truth, of looking for truth that isn't simply subjective, even though subjective truths do exist. And so he named it right off the bat. And him coming to his conclusion about the life of Jesus was just refreshing to me. Actually, I was referring directly to that when I was saying his clear, logical process of one step after another, mm-hmm. right? That helped him affirm, this is the most reasonable thing for me, right? And when he was had that kind of disposition of the reasonableness, he was obviously given a grace there. Like mm-hmm. a grace to say yes, because one thing that there is a kind of I don't want to call it a gap as much as it's a springboard by which, I don't know, one's mind, one's reason transcends itself. And that's the gift of faith, right? Where it's using reasonable things and then it gets skyrocketed into a different place.
Yeah.
Based on those principles. So he had that moment. And for me, I have had that moment but I didn't come to it in the same way that he did. I had to go back to those reasons, those very logical conclusions years later, actually.
Mm.
Because I'm a man of intuition versus one. And so I trust my intuition more than anything. And I trust that my intuition leads me to reality, and therefore it's vetted then, not I have to vet my intuition now and then proceed. Right. I kind of like to go into the mix and then realize it's true.
Yeah.
And then if it's not true, then I leave. But
yeah, I really do. I love Brandon is one of the. In the world of the Internet, this is something I just want to say. It's a pivot. Totally. It's one of the kindest people I know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That guy is super, like, he came to my seminary a couple of years ago.
I was going to ask you about that in a second. Yeah. So you went to
Mundelein.
Mundelein Seminary.
Mundelein.
Where at that time, Father Bobby Barron, now Bishop Robert Barron, was the rector at that point in time, right? Mm-hmm. So Brandon was working for him when he was the rector at the seminary, right?
Yes. And so he would bring Brandon up on several occasions or whatever. And I never really got a chance to talk with Brandon's a lot, but, you know, I mean, I don't know what it's, I can remember my first time going up to in front of all these theologians, right? Men who are in the theology process of their seminary. And the first time I'm in front of them being like, okay, here are all these dudes. They all have the same look on their face because they're all paying attention. So they have this kind of like just serious look on their face. They're all wearing black and we're all sitting in rows because we're at tables. And it's just kind of intimidating, or intimidating might be the wrong word, just unnerving. And so he walks in there and he's just like kind of like just super calm, unselfconscious, smiling, right? Nothing really, you know, I think he's just happy. So the guy just came off as having a really good vibes and super happy. When I had interactions with him, he was just very clear and very, very kind. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, so he's, yeah, I think he is just, and it's really funny because he gets into really heated discussions and dialogues with folks, and these conversations that are in some ways very similar to the ones we have, but are very adversarial sometimes, more so because it's the internet and you're not an actual person that person's engaging with. You're just a screen and an abstract concept of a person. So I watch people unleash on him, and in return, very directly, like he doesn't just like smile and like take it on the chin, but he never seems to lose it. Like he never really seems to like lose his cool. He just stays completely unperturbed. And it's one of the things I love about him. And it's not an unpassionate placidity. Like I think a lot of people think of like more evolved people being like just unconcerned. Like, I don't care. And I don't think that he comes across as uncaring in any way, just unperturbed by it. And I just think that's really awesome because it's hard. It's hard a lot of the time.
He's probably got a level of discipline that myself, I don't have.
Yeah.
Right. And that's part of his temperament and personality. Part of it's just my lack of virtue. But you know, the other thing that, sorry, on a different note, that was something I just want to affirm about him is, you know, I, on that note, is his kind of awareness of how to have a dialogue, how to have an argument. So, I mean, I do listen to a lot of Bishop Barron. You know, Bishop Barron taught me Trinitarian theology, and I like listening to him preach. I like listening to his talks. And I also like Brandon because Brandon has an affinity for, you know, in that way for Bishop Barron, he has an affinity in that way. He follows Bishop Barron's kind of method of thinking a little bit. And Brandon's, I was going back to one of Brandon's books last night and realizing that I had seen him write the same thing elsewhere. Right. I mean, everybody recycles material, but I think it's maybe a little bit disingenuous to say that. It's more of that people hit on the same theme multiple times because that's the theme, or that's the thing that they've most been given life from, right? Yeah. They receive life from that theme, right? So they want to repeat it. And reading this, a couple of sections of this book, like it was talking about asking questions, just simply asking questions. And I really appreciate, and he brought that up in an interview, right? Just simply asking questions to people. And it's just, he lives out of that kind of liberation of saying, where is truth here? Mm-hmm. Right. And his kind of desire for truth and finding it in his interlocutors, as he likes to say, and I like saying that now more and more, you know, I think is something that's really beautiful. And I think that's why it's good to have him on this podcast, is because he at least gives me kind of a regrounding in the fact that even if you're just a very clear and method oriented mind like he is, it's still the same dynamic. Yeah. I just want to see what your life is. Yeah. And I have questions for you to go deeper.
Well, I want to affirm that my heater just turned on, and I don't know what that's going to do to any of the sound in the background. So it may be nothing, absolutely.
As long as we don't sound like munchkins.
But we won't. Yeah, so last week we were on Catching Fox and we sound like munchkins. But we're also at the 15-minute mark. So that's it for us today. I do need you to pick a number between 1 and 7 for me.
6.
And I'm going to figure out in just a little bit who that means won some beard balm, and then I'm going to come back and do a closeout. Do you have something else you want to say?
I just wanted to ask a question.
Yeah.
For Brandon. Yeah, I'd want to ask Brandon. He was talking about how he considered Catholicism because of his wife, right? And he had maybe two sentences, maybe just one, about the fact that he just wanted to take her seriously, right, in her faith when he was basically a Methodist, I think he said. My question would be, tell us more about that, right? Like, what was that that made you take your wife's faith more seriously? I mean, I get that it was just an honest love and respect for her, and but I almost wanted to hear more about that.
Cool. Well, next time we have Brandon on, if we ever have him on in the future, maybe we'll get Bishop Barron on sometime, and Brandon can join us for just a little bit.
We'll ask him that. Hey, Brandon, by the way, I want to message you about how to read books faster. So
anyway. Yeah, Father Parrish wants to read books faster, and I told him he had a course, but apparently you don't sell it anymore. So let's see if we can make Father Parrish read faster. Because
I got to read better, guys. We got to read more better.
We were discussing this the other day, and I go through about 6 books a week, and he goes through about 1 book every 6 weeks.
Yeah, I'm just super slow, and I'm a social butterfly.
Yeah, I'll just stop. I'll just ignore people and read a book instead.
Damn, I can't do that.
Yeah, my wife doesn't like it when I do that.
Oh.
Because she's usually that person. All right, guys, so until next week, get out there, F and F ability, and talk about what really mattered.
Bye!